Welcome to The Reference Desk, a podcast where two librarians take you down the rabbit hole of the topics that have bewitched us.
So adjust the chain on your reading glasses, button up your favorite cardigan, and follow us punk-ass book jockeys through the stacks to The Reference Desk.
Welcome to The Reference Desk.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Haley.
And thanks for being here.
Hooray.
Haley, thank you for quite literally peeling yourself off the floor.
I mean, I would like to be on the floor. Yeah. Yes, this is Haley. You probably can't tell.
Oh,
I sound so different. Yeah. So I've been sick for a week and a half. I don't know. Long time. So fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't.
So what's been going on with you?
What is going on with me? I don't know. I feel like life is just like a long series of just thinking that things will get better, easier at some point next week, next month, whatever. And then it just doesn't.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. We have like this project going on in our house where we're working on some stuff, and so my house is a wreck, but I don't want to clean because there's like piles of like construction materials everywhere. So
yeah,
it seems silly to be worried about like cat hair on the couch when there's sawdust everywhere.
Yeah, totally. That's frustrating.
Yeah, I just want it done. Yeah, how about you?
Just dying.
Just slowly dying.
Just, you know. Rewatching a lot of Schitt's Creek.
That's the best.
That's like, it's now my comfort show, like more so than like The Office or anything. I've been turning to Schitt's Creek a lot. I just love how it's so like subtle, where it's like the message is not, you know, they're not shoving like, you know, anything in your face. It's just like, look at how all of these different people can just get along and not have conflicts like that. Like, it's so beautiful.
It really is. It really is. Or that even like when they have the conflicts and it seems like, oh my God, how, like, why would these people like even ever be friends again?
Right.
Like they come back together.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's so good. I was watching it all while I was homesick, and also like whenever I had like an hour where I was lucid, I was like trying to work from home, and then I would be like, no, I'm dying now. Just watch Schitt's Creek some more. But I got to like the almost the last episode. I was like, no, I don't want it to be over. I'm going to watch it again. So I started from the very beginning.
Oh,
so I've seen it like three times all the way through. I was like, no.
Yeah. It does have a great ending though.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Sometimes with shows like that you love so much, the ending can be such a disappointment.
Yeah, it just, like, the character growth at the end is so noticeable. Like they they just let them go on the journey that they've, you know, been building up to. It's fantastic. Love it.
It's so good. Now I want to rewatch it too.
Do it. Yeah, so good.
So is that your staff pick?
It's not. I actually have different staff picks.
Ooh.
This week I have two, and they are picture books. And these books won the Caldecott and then a Caldecott Honor this year. Those were just announced in January. For those who are not in like the children's literature space or not into children's literature, I don't know. The Caldecott Award is awarded every year by the American Library Association, more specifically the ALSC, which is, oh gosh, what is that? That is the Association for Library Services to Children. That's what it is. So they award the Caldecott to the picture book with the most distinguished illustrations of the year. And so this year, the award went to one of my favorite illustrators. I love her so much. And this was her first time also writing the book. And it's Big by Vashti Harrison. Did you see this?
Yes.
Oh,
yes. It's so beautiful.
Stunning. Yes, it is so stunning. Her illustration style is like exactly what I love. There's like minimal outlines. So it's just like color. And it's like very soft, but with really modern color palettes. It's It's fantastic. And the way she draws people is so adorable.
It really is. Yes.
And the book is just fantastic. It starts, "Once there was a girl, she had a big laugh and a big heart and very big dreams. And it was good until it wasn't." Mm-hmm. And it follows this little girl who, you know, growing up, she's getting bigger and she's learning new things. Everyone in her life keeps telling her, "You're getting so big," and it's a good thing. But then she gets older and she's still getting bigger. And all of a sudden she's, you know, told that she's too big for ballet, or she's too big to be crying the way that she is. And it's, you know, this just absolutely beautiful message of how words can hurt, but then they can also heal. And it shows her as she learns to love herself no matter what anyone else says. And it's such an impactful book with such like sparse text. Like, mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Love it, love it, love it. I recommend it. Even if you don't have kids, just read it. It's phenomenal. And then so good.
Children's books can be so healing for adults.
Yes. Picture books are phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. There's so many of these books that like we needed when we were kids and we didn't have them, but that doesn't mean that we can't read them now.
Oh, totally. Totally. And that's such a good, this is a great one for that. It's just such a good message. Yeah. Ugh, love it. And then the next book was A Caldecott Honor. So it didn't win the award, but it was nominated, or it was honored. And that is There Was a Party for Langston by Jason Reynolds. And it's illustrated by Jerome and Jarrett Pumphrey. And I've talked about how much I love Jason Reynolds before and how lucky I was to see him speak at the last library conference I went to. This is his first picture book, and it is based on a photograph that he found of some of his favorite authors, Maya Angelou and Amiri Baraka. They are in this photo, they're just like absolutely getting down and dancing at some sort of party. Like, they look fantastic. And the more he researched this picture, he found out that it was taken at a party celebrating Langston Hughes at the Schomburg Library. So the book gives like brief introductions to these amazing authors with really lyrical language and a special attention to their contributions to literature and their style of writing. But it's just so accessible for kids. Like, it's so good. And I love the illustrations. It's illustrated by two brothers, the Pumphrey brothers. And I love that they create art together. That's so cute. But they used words to make up a lot of the images. So there's like hidden words in all of the images. Mm. It's almost got like a mid-century advertisement kind of style to it. And it's beautiful. Just, yeah. Recommend it to everyone. Love it.
Pick that one up.
Yeah, it's so pretty.
So I feel like I've come full circle because I am currently rereading Outlander.
Okay.
So I don't really have like a recommendation for a book, but I did want to share something. Mm-hmm. So I do like 90% of my reading that isn't like for work or for the podcast on my Kindle in bed at the end of the day. I never thought that I would be like a Kindle person, but after breastfeeding a baby and only having one free hand to hold a book, that like totally changed my life. Mm-hmm. And I just haven't gone back.
Yeah.
So anyways, I do borrow most of my books from my library using the Libby app, which if you aren't using, oh my God,
do it.
You need to do it.
And there's like library cards that you can get from other states that just like let anybody get a library card and you don't have to be there. You could just apply online. So many free books.
Yes, I have, you know, like my local library card. And then I think it was like $50 to get a library card to Houston Public Libraries.
Okay.
They're one of the ones that offer it. So I have a card there too, because my library district is so small that sometimes like I just want more.
Totally.
But anyways, there's times when like even with Libby and how much I love it and how great it is, it just seems like I just can't find what I want to read that's available. Or like if it's something from an author that I already know that I love and I know that I'm going to read it again and again, I just want to buy it. Mm. But like books can be pricey. Mm-hmm. And I just recently started using the Kindle daily and monthly deal lists. I've never used these before, and I'm so mad that I didn't know about them sooner. So I want to tell everyone in case you don't realize they're there.
Yeah.
So like when you open the Kindle store on your Kindle or on the Amazon website, there's like a section that says Kindle deals, and there's a daily deals list, which is usually like 100 books and they change every day. And then monthly deals, which is like thousands of Kindle editions of books. And they're all like 80% off.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie, like 95% of them don't look great.
Sure. Yeah.
But there are always a few gems in there that I love to pick up, like just to add to my Kindle. So when I find myself not able to find something on Libby, I have them. And I checked right before I got on here, and like just on the first page, there was an Ann Patchett for $1.99. There was a Christina Lauren for $2.99, a Taylor Jenkins Reid for $2.99, Allison Cochran for $1.99. Like, and that was just on the first page. I didn't even like look into any of the genres or anything. And you can shop by price too. So if you only like literally only have a dollar to spend on a book, you can just look for books that are less than a dollar. And you don't have to have a Kindle to use this. You can read it like on your computer, on your phone, whatever. I know that reading can feel like an expensive hobby to get into, especially when you see like the book talkers who have read 25 new release hardcovers. And you're
yesterday.
Like, yeah. And you're like, how the hell do I afford to do this? But I think like by using your local library and then like using these deals, you can do it very affordably.
Yeah.
And I did look into it a little bit, and it appears that the authors can opt in or out of their books appearing on these deal lists. So they get to make the call on like if they want to sell for a reduced price and have, you know, reduced royalties in exchange for higher sales or whatever. So
yeah, that's great.
That did make me feel better about it. Like, I don't love buying books from Amazon at all. But like I said, books are expensive, and sometimes, you know, any way that you can get your hands on a book is good.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if you're buying a physical copy, there are so many good like secondhand online bookstores now. Local libraries usually sell books secondhand. And I saw that like a lot of book talkers now will sell like their entire like monthly stacks on Pango once they're done with them, like at the end of the month.
Interesting.
And they're selling them, you know, for like $2 to $3 each.
Wow.
And then you just have to pay for shipping. But so, yeah, check out the Kindle deals and keep reading however you can, however you can afford it. There's so many affordable ways to do it.
Yeah. I will now. I'm so selective. Yeah. Like I only want to read on my Kindle. Like if the option is like I can't find it for my Kindle, I probably won't read it unless I can find the audiobook, because I also really like audiobooks. I only read in bed now, because that's the only time I freaking have to read. The website Book Riot, do you ever read that?
Yes,
they do like a wrap up at the week of at the end of the week of like the best Kindle deals. So yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, are we ready to get into this topic?
I think so.
So my last topic was pretty depressing. I mean, I don't know. I you know, there were some survivors, but you know, it was a tough topic.
Sure.
And my planned topic for this week was also very dark, but I've had some pretty crappy weeks lately. You know, they've been adjusting what I call my brain meds, and I am so out of whack. Everything feels devastating and terrible. And so I just really wanted something light and fun. So this was another last minute topic change. And it came about because of a recent holiday that we just celebrated here in the United States and also in Canada. And celebrated may be a loose term, because I don't know who actually like celebrates this holiday.
Oh, okay.
But it just got me thinking about the weird things that we do here in America, like all of the weird traditions that we uphold just because we've done them forever. I'm looking at you, empirical system. Like, come on. And so I started looking into these things and it made me smile. So today I am bewitched by Punxsutawney Phil, Groundhog Day, and other strange American traditions.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I love this. Will we be discussing the Bill Murray film?
Very, just a little tiny bit. It's just mentioned.
God, what a great movie.
Yes. I know. As I was doing this, I was like, Tom, we should watch Groundhog Day. Let's do this. We never got around to it because we have a child who only will watch Bluey and Puffin Rock. And now Thomas, the train.
Oh, no.
Which is terrible. Oh, God. No. It's so annoying. So annoying.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you have Apple TV Plus?
We don't. Okay. I've been thinking about it because I know they have Otis. I think that was a book series, The Tractor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have several good children's programs that don't like make me want to gouge my eyes out.
I know. Ugh.
It's painful.
So bad. Like Bluey, I'm fine. I will watch Bluey all day, any day. I don't care about Bluey for sure. And Puffin Rock, I don't know if you've seen that one.
No, that one's very like sweet and gentle.
Very, totally. Mm-hmm. Even today, after I got home from work, Finn was watching it and he goes, this makes me feel calm.
Oh,
good.
Then keep watching.
Yes. Watch this and not stupid Thomas. Okay. He's in a real big train phase right now, though. He's playing with all his little wooden train tracks and stuff. He's real big into it. All right. So Groundhog Day is celebrated on February 2nd in the United States and Canada. It is based on the belief that if a groundhog emerges from its burrow on this day and sees its shadow, winter will continue for 6 more weeks. And if the groundhog does not see its shadow, spring will come early, which was the prediction this year. Groundhog did not see his shadow, so apparently we're getting an early spring.
Isn't that pretty rare?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're going to get to that.
We'll talk about the accuracy of his predictions. So the origins of Groundhog Day can be traced back to an ancient Celtic festival called Imbolc, which marked the midpoint between the winter solstice and the spring equinox, as well as an ancient Christian celebration known as Candlemas Day, which also marked the midpoint between the winter solstice and the spring equinox, because, you know, those Christians were just taking all the pagan holidays to renaming try to convert them. People.
Yep.
So Candlemas has its origins in ancient Roman and Celtic traditions, where candles were used to mark the end of winter and the coming of spring. In the early Christian church, Candlemas became associated with the presentation of Jesus, and it was customary for Christians to take their candles to the church to have them blessed on this day.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, me either. They felt that this would bring blessings to their household for the remainder of the winter. Sounds pretty witchy to me, Christians.
Yeah.
Superstition held that if the day was sunny and clear, people could expect a long, rough winter. But if the sky was cloudy, warm weather would soon arrive. So that's kind of the beginnings of the little weather prediction stuff.
Okay.
There's an old English folk song that says, if Candlemas be fair and bright, come winter have another flight. If Candlemas brings clouds and rain, go winter and come not again. Several traditions that are part of weather lore use animals to predict the weather at Candlemas. There we go.
Okay.
So in Germany, if the hedgehog saw his shadow on Candlemas, there would be a second winter or 6 more weeks of bad weather. But in other areas of the world, it could have been a bear or a fox or a badger.
Wait, they would have a bear at the church service?
I guess, yeah. No.
I mean, I would go to church to see that.
To see a bear. So how did we get groundhogs in North America? So this can be traced back to German immigrants who settled in Pennsylvania in the 18th and 19th century, known as the Pennsylvania Dutch. So let's talk a bit about who exactly the Pennsylvania Dutch are, and sadly not about Dwight Schrute's Pennsylvania Dutch Christmas.
Darn it!
I know. We can do a whole episode on Belschnickel.
Oh, please. Impish or admirable.
So the Pennsylvania Dutch are a group of people that dates back to the 17th and 18th century. And despite their name, the Pennsylvania Dutch are not Dutch, but rather of Germanic origin, primarily from regions that are now part of modern day Germany and Switzerland. And the term Dutch is actually kind of a corruption of the word Deutsch, meaning German in the German language.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes so much more sense. I've always wondered, like, were people just real ignorant? I mean, yes.
So, Deutsch, because they call it what, the Deutschland, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's Germany. Yeah. The Pennsylvania Dutch begin arriving in the American colonies in the late 17th century, seeking religious freedom and economic opportunities. Many of them were Anabaptists. And this includes Mennonites, the Amish, and Brethren. And they faced persecution in their homeland due to their beliefs in adult baptism and pacifism. Can't have those pacifists here.
No.
So these German-speaking immigrants settled primarily in Pennsylvania, particularly in the southeastern part of the state, where they established very tight-knit farming communities. Over time, the Pennsylvania Dutch developed a unique culture that blended elements of their German heritage with influences from their new American surroundings. One of the most enduring aspects of Pennsylvania Dutch culture is their distinctive dialect, known as Pennsylvania German or Pennsylvania Dutch, which Dwight speaks fluently, of course. So it's actually a blend of various German dialects spoken by all of the different groups of immigrants who settled in the region. And it is still spoken by some members of the Pennsylvania Dutch community today, particularly among the Amish and Old Order Mennonites. They're also known for their folk art, including colorful hex signs, intricate quilts, and handcrafted furniture. And these traditional crafts reflect the values of the community, such as hard work, frugality, and a strong connection to the land.
Amish-made furniture is a quality.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amazing. And expensive. But amazing.
And expensive. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You see like the signs on the side of the road and you're like, oh, this will be a good deal.
No. 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 It will last you forever. Yes. But it will not be cheap.
Yes. Just because they don't have electricity does not mean that they're not like making some money.
Yeah. It takes them 800 years to make a piece of furniture. So they have to charge for it.
Yeah.
They've also preserved many culinary traditions, including hearty dishes like sauerkraut, scrapple, and shoofly pie.
What
which I meant to look up
pie?
And I didn't look up. So, what is shoofly pie?
I love sauerkraut.
Ooh. Molasses. That's what it says. The star of the show is molasses.
It's a molasses.
Oh, so it's, yeah. So there's like brown sugar, nutmeg, molasses. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I like a molasses cookie.
Sure.
Molasses pie is good.
Yeah. It says it's similar to a coffee cake, but with a gooey molasses bottom.
Hmm.
All right.
Okay. Does it keep the flies away?
I guess so. Why would that be, though?
Yeah,
so I feel like molasses would attract flies.
Maybe it's like so attractive that every time they eat it, they're like, shoo fly.
Oh, I'm sure that's it. They have to shoo the flies off the path.
Shoo the flies away because it's so delicious.
Okay, and so along with all of these wonderfully rich traditions, they also brought along the tradition of Candlemas, but there was a distinct lack of hedgehogs in North America. And so it forced them to choose a different animal to carry on their weather traditions. So they switched to groundhogs because they were plentiful.
I wonder how many animals they, like, tried out.
So it doesn't work.
If there was like voting involved, this is like an American Idol type situation.
It totally was. They tried bears first, but they got eaten. So
yeah, that I'm sure did not last long.
Their new tradition is that if a hedgehog saw its shadow on February 2nd, it would burrow back underground, and winter would last for 6 more weeks. And if it did not see its shadow, it would stay out of its burrow, and that meant that spring would come early.
Okay.
So here are some fun groundhog facts, just in case.
Yes, absolutely.
They're also called woodchucks, which I thought those were two different animals.
Yeah, I did too. I definitely did too.
Yeah.
Okay, well, my life's ruined.
Right? They typically weigh 12 to 15 pounds, and they live 6 to 8 years. They eat vegetables and fruits, and they whistle when they're frightened, and they can also climb trees and swim.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That sounds really cute.
We had a groundhog that lived in our backyard at the last house we were in a, it was, I swear that thing was 4 feet tall. It was so fucking big.
They're big. Huge. I mean, even when like I see the Groundhog Day thing on the news, I'm always like, oh, wow, that's a big animal.
Yeah. So big. Oy. And groundhogs were definitely especially plentiful because in the late 1800s, a hunting club was formed called the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club. And it was this group that began using groundhogs in Punxsutawney to carry out their Candlemas weather predictions. Newspapers in Punxsutawney began publishing reports of Groundhog's Day celebrations in February of 1886. So those were the first kind of mentions of it. Though in the early years of the club, the town placed emphasis on the annual groundhog hunt held in September.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah, they ate a lot of groundhogs. that was. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now not knowing what a groundhog or a woodchuck is, I have no idea what that animal would even taste like.
Ooh, yeah, I don't. Mm-mm.
It's like a big rodent.
Yeah, essentially. Gross. Mm.
Yeah.
No, thank you. So politicians and journalists started traveling to Punxsutawney every year after the railroad arrived in 1899. And as time went on, the hunt and feast that followed became increasingly lavish. A newspaper called the Punxsutawney Spirit reported that more than 150 people turned up for the 1910 groundhog hunt outside of town on the land called Gobbler's Knob.
Oh my God. No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my God. If I ever become like a wealthy landowner, that's mm-hmm. what I'm naming my estate.
Gobbler's Knob. That's where they still have the celebrations today, too, on Gobbler's Knob.
Well, then I will name mine Knobbler's Gob. So they can't sue me.
Perfection. The club opened its festivities by belting out the official groundhog song written by its eldest member.
No, there's and a the, song.
There's a song. I know. I'm not going to sing it, obviously. But
what do you mean, words, obviously?
I am a man right now. I sound like I don't even know. The words are, we had a pie all made of rye, and groundhog was the meat. We have enough and plenty too, and more than we can eat. So.
Oh my God.
They just would.
Heaps of groundhog pies.
So many groundhogs.
So many.
So that would open the hunt. And according to history.com, armed not with guns and dogs, but with shovels, hoes, and rubber hoses to listen underground, the club members proceeded to the hunt. When the familiar groundhog used by the townspeople to forecast the weather every February 2nd, so they have like a specific groundhog that they're looking for. It's not called a Phil yet. It's just this groundhog. When it would pop its head out of the ground, the hunt leader bellowed, the official woodchuck is holed. This is like very, yes, very official. So after racing to the hole and digging ferociously for a while, the hunters in their suits and caps, like, so they're like dressed all fancy, eventually uncovered the groundhog, who was set free for a chase by the club members after they had taken a picture with it.
Oh my God. Wait, but then they chased it?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they dig it out of its burrow, take a picture with it, and then set it free so they can chase it.
And kill it, I'm assuming?
Not this one.
Oh, not this one. This one is to be terrified for fun.
Yeah, this is the special weather predicting groundhog. All of his friends are going to get eaten, though. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, during this description of this 1910 hunt, the groundhog eluded capture for 5 minutes before finally being corralled by its tail. And then the men poured a groundhog punch, which was an elixir made from vodka, milk, and orange juice, said to add 7 years to the groundhog's life down the creature's throat.
I'm pretty sure we drank that in college.
Probably.
Oh, my God. You know, I'm just thinking that, like, before colonists, this land was full of beautiful indigenous traditions. You know, like, when they would hunt, they truly respected their kill and, like, what the earth was giving them. And yeah, we could have had that, but instead, we went with this.
We chased a groundhog and made it drink vodka.
Yeah, that's classic America.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And so while the weather-predicting groundhog was toasted and celebrated, the group finished their celebration on this 1910 hunt by feasting on 41 groundhogs that had already been captured, killed, and marinated, as groundhog was a delicacy in Pennsylvania at the time.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm. In September 1913, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which was another newspaper, revealed that the yearly groundhog hunt resulted in the deaths of 100 groundhogs. And the newspaper joked, if those people aren't careful, they'll find themselves next February without any means of predicting how long the winter is going to last. Okay, Cleveland.
No.
Articles concerning the town's celebration of Groundhog Day started to surface in national headlines, and reporters from print and then eventually to radio and television started traveling to Punxsutawney on February 2nd of each year. And as the popularity in the event grew, the club eventually gave up the hunt portion of the event because people were just there for the weather predicting part.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't until 1961 when the groundhog became known as Phil.
Okay.
Most sources say that he eventually earned the name Phil as homage to King Philip, but it's never really mentioned which King Philip. So we know that the origins of the holiday came from German tradition, but that country hasn't seen a King Philip in over 8 centuries. So it's not likely to be that King Philip. And so according to Mental Floss, France, Greece, Spain, and even the Wampanoag people of New England have all had a King Philip, but it's very unlikely that a small Germanic Pennsylvania community would ever name their beloved groundhog after any of these kings either. So I don't know. Mental Floss, that author, his theory is that the name might actually refer to a prince, and it may have gotten its start thanks to a pair of heinous murders and some good old-fashioned small-town competition.
Woohoo!
So in 1953, 2 baby groundhogs were sent by Punxsutawney to the Griffith Park Zoo in Los Angeles as a gift. The creatures were called after the future prince, not King Philip, and Queen Elizabeth II. So that's what they were named after.
Okay.
And because that was the newly established royal couple in Britain at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And while the LA Zoo welcomed them and were very excited to receive these groundhogs, the state of California was not happy. The baby groundhogs were deemed agricultural pests by the California Department of Agriculture and ordered them to be destroyed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, of course, Punxsutawney was outraged, and the head of the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club worried that the killings would spark an international incident because of the groundhogs' names. He told the LA Times, "I'm going to ask my congressman to take the matter up with the State Department so we won't get into complications with England. Killing these groundhogs was an insult to the royal family."
Oh my God. Oh, wow. The diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with tough issues.
Especially because that congressional representative actually did issue a statement criticizing California. And the two groundhogs were eventually buried back home in Punxsutawney.
So they did kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They did.
Oh, why didn't they just send them back?
Right?
It seems kind of harsh.
I know. It's weird. Especially because the zoo is like, all right.
Yeah. Like, I get being concerned about like an invasive species, but.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a risk you run with any zoo animal escaping?
Right.
I'm assuming that the zoo people know what they're doing.
I hope so. Yeah. Boy. So again, according to Mental Floss, 8 years later, the name Punxsutawney Phil first appeared in newspapers. And it's possible that this new moniker was a shout out to one of those dearly deceased royal groundhogs. But that's just
shout
speculation.
Out.
Yeah, because nobody has said for sure where this name came from.
Hashtag justice for Phil.
Oh. And of course, the tradition has grown in popularity, especially after the 1993 Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day. So the movie also stars Andy McDowell and Chris Elliott and tells the story of a cynical television weatherman covering the annual Groundhog Day event in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, who becomes trapped in a time loop, forcing him to relive February 2nd repeatedly. Not filmed in Punxsutawney, though. Just was not filmed there.
They never are.
No. So according to the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club, which is still a thing, by the way, they're the ones that like put on the whole shebang.
Do they still hunt groundhogs?
No, I don't think they hunt them.
Okay.
No, this is their primary focus now, is just weather prediction.
Just this one 5-minute event every year.
Literally, yeah. So according to their website, since the first celebrations, there have been many notable happenings around the holiday. So according to them, during Prohibition, Phil threatened to impose 60 weeks of winter on the community if he wasn't allowed a drink.
Give me my vodka and milk and orange juice. had an agreement.
Listen. In 1981, Phil wore a yellow ribbon in honor of the American hostages in Iran. Phil traveled to Washington, D.C. in 1986 to meet President Reagan. He was joined by Groundhog Club President Jim Means.
Is there nothing that Ronald Reagan hasn't touched? I mean,
no.
My God.
No, it's everything.
He has to ruin Groundhog Day for me. I celebrate privately.
Oh, God. Phil appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show in 1995. In the years following the release of the movie, record crowds numbering as high as 30,000 have visited Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney.
I know. I want a t-shirt.
Gobbler's Knob. Oh my gosh, yes. I'm sure there are.
I have to look and see if there's Gobbler's Knob merch.
There has to be. There has to be.
You can absolutely buy Gobbler's Knob t-shirts.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. Okay.
Okay, sorry. I'll just be shopping the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club's official apparel section.
It's really good information to have.
It really is. It's going to be my entire wardrobe.
Perfection.
There's some. Oh, okay.
In 1998, Groundhog Day was first broadcast live worldwide via the internet.
Ooh.
In 2001, Phil's prediction was shown live on the Jumbotron at Times Square.
Big moment for Phil.
Definitely a big moment. So today, Groundhog Day is celebrated in various ways across North America, but Punxsutawney's event is the most popular. So there are other like weather predicting animals on Groundhog Day, but
what?
I mean, yeah, I know.
How dare they?
Phil just steals the show, though.
Well, naturally.
Yeah. Thousands of people gather at Gobbler's Knob before dawn on February 2nd to witness Phil predict the weather. The Punxsutawney Groundhog Club's ceremony includes music, entertainment, and the reading of Phil's weather prediction by the Inner Circle. According to their website, the Inner Circle is the Groundhog Club. Just read this for a minute. The Inner Circle is the Groundhog Club's inner circle.
That is quality writing right there.
The Inner Circle is a group of local dignitaries responsible for carrying on the tradition of Groundhog Day every year. They're the ones who are not only responsible for planning the events every year, but they're also responsible for the feeding and care of Phil himself.
Aww.
Yeah. So we're going to go see what happened this year, this Groundhog Day. So the celebration started on February 1st, the day before, with the Gobbler's Knob Got Talent show. This was an open judged talent show where those entering perform, and two finalists will be chosen to perform at Gobbler's Knob on Groundhog Morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the winner will also be awarded $500.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. That afternoon, there was a Groundhog Club members only reception, followed by the annual Groundhog Banquet with an evening of dueling pianos and alcoholic beverages later that night.
No.
So it was like a rollicking good time.
That actually sounds kind of fun. I love dueling pianos.
Yeah. Except that if you want a good spot, the following morning, a Gobbler's Knob grounds opens at 3 a.m.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, and just keep in mind, Phil makes his predictions around 7:30. So people are just there at 3 lining up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So Phil makes his predictions, but the fun is not over after that. Phil will then make an appearance at a ticketed Lunch with Phil event. Yeah. No groundhog on the menu.
Oh, God. Thank God.
Yeah, no. It's just a special lunch. And there is another groundhog ball, which is usually themed.
Ooh.
According to the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club, there has only ever been one Phil, Katie. He is immortal.
Really?
Just one Phil.
No, that's not fair. I specifically asked for Moo to be immortal.
Right.
And the fact that this fucking groundhog got it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Because this gets...
I don't know what's happening. A note of panic in your voice.
Oh my God.
It's okay. It's just groundhogs.
Okay. So yeah, only one Phil, and he's kept alive by drinking the elixir of life, which is a secret recipe. I don't know if it still contains vodka.
I'm sure.
Probably. Phil takes one sip every summer at the Groundhog Picnic, and it magically gives him 7 more years of life. But Phil has a wife named Phyllis.
No.
Who is not given the elixir of life.
Rude.
Right? So I don't know how many Phyllises there have been. They didn't mention that.
well, whenever he feels like a new one, he can just.
Yeah. Because obviously men are running this entire celebration.
Obviously.
Yeah. The Groundhog Club also says that Phil's predictions are accurate 100% of the time. But he actually has a pretty abysmal record. He is only, since like the 1800s, he has only been correct 36% of the time.
What?
36%.
That's really bad.
That's real bad. Yeah. He is failing at weather prediction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They would be better off flipping a coin.
Yep.
Oh, no.
And lastly, before we move on to the next weird tradition, my favorite fact is that when Phil is not predicting the weather, he spends his time in a climate-controlled habitat built into the library.
Oh, I love that.
He lives at the library.
Oh, does Phyllis live with him?
I don't know. I'm probably not.
What?
No, I don't know.
Poor Phyllis.
Right?
I want to start a club for her.
I know. Now I'm specifically going to look that up because I don't remember. Does Phyllis live with Phil? Groundhog. Yes, Phyllis does live with Phil in the zoo, in the library zoo.
Oh my God. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so this next weird tradition I have never understood, like ever. I hate it so much. And this is the pardoning of the turkey on Thanksgiving.
Yes, yes. What the hell, like, is up with that?
Why? Why?
Yeah, I agree. Don't like that.
Yeah, so of course, this is another American holiday. And Katie did a fabulous episode on the real Thanksgiving. So go listen to that, because this is not the real Thanksgiving. And part of the weirdest part of Thanksgiving to me has always been the pardoning of this one singular turkey. Like, stupid. It's an annual tradition. It takes place on the day before Thanksgiving. They really cut it down to the wire. This turkey's thinking he's going to go. And then
I know. Then he gets a stay of execution.
Yeah, just one, though. Like all
just
the others.
Just one. Oh, God.
So there are a few claims as to who the first president to pardon a turkey was. The first president to unofficially pardon a turkey was Abraham Lincoln, who instructed the White House to save a bird given to the president because his son had grown very fond of it.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cute.
That's very cute.
Yeah, I like that.
The first mentions of turkeys being given as gifts to presidents date back to the 1870s, when a Rhode Island poultry dealer, Horace Vose, began sending turkeys to the White House. His yearly offering gained his farm widespread publicity and became a veritable institution at the White House.
Imagine just being able to send a live animal.
Here you go, Mr. President. Here's a turkey.
And it making it
yeah.
to the president.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
After Vose's death in 1914, the opportunity to give a turkey to the president was open to everyone.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And poultry gifts were frequent. Many credit the tradition to President Truman, who received a live turkey as a gift from the National Turkey Federation as a joke. Because from September to November 1947, announcements of the government encouraging poultryless Thursdays. So it outraged homemakers, restaurant owners, and the poultry industry was very charged in Washington. And it came to a head when the poultry industry pointed out that the upcoming Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Day, the three biggest turkey holidays, happened to fall on Thursday. So they were going to lose all their money. And so they didn't want the government saying not to eat poultry on Thursdays.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it was like part of the war effort or something. I don't know the specifics of why the government was asking people not to eat poultry on Thursday, but
yeah, interesting.
It was a campaign and the poultry industry was like, nah. Luckily, it was not luckily, I don't know. It was deflated before Thanksgiving. But not before poultry growers had sent crates of live chickens called Hens for Harry to the White House in protest.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He just kept getting chickens. And the turkey that they presented to Truman that December promoted the poultry industry and established an annual news niche that endures today. So because of this, he is often credited as being the first to pardon a turkey, but it wasn't like he was officially doing it. He was just given this turkey, and it would have been a bad move, I guess. I don't know. And it was very sporadic after that, that presidents would be given turkeys and then let them go instead of eating them. But it wasn't ever like a, this is the thing we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to mention that Truman ended up sending that turkey to a farm. So that was like, and then sporadically presidents after that would then like, all the turkeys that they were given as gifts, they would send some to the farms to live. I don't know.
Is this like a real farms or like when you're a kid and your cat dies and it goes to live at the farm?
I don't know.
Okay. All right.
Honestly, I'm not sure. I thought it was a real farm, but who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So after 1981, when the practice of sending like the gifted turkeys to a farm became the norm under Reagan, the formalities of pardoning the turkey gelled by 1989 when George H.W. Bush, with animal rights activists picketing nearby, joked, quote, "But let me assure you and this fine Tom Turkey that he will not end up on anyone's dinner table. Not this guy. He's granted a presidential pardon as of right now and allow him to live out his days on a children's farm not far from here." So he was the first to actually term it a presidential pardon. And since then, every president has continued the tradition of pardoning a turkey. Turkeys are usually chosen from farms in states that are major turkey producers. And the pardoning ceremony is typically held on the South Lawn of the White House and is attended by the president, the first lady, and other government officials. After being pardoned, the turkeys are usually sent to live at a farm or a petting zoo, and some turkeys have even been given honorary positions such as Grand Marshal of the Presidential Turkey Pardon or Ambassador of Goodwill. It's just weird.
It's so weird. I understand tradition is important. People like traditions, but my God.
Yeah.
Don't our elected officials have better things to be doing?
Right.
Than
yes, they do.
Pardoning a freaking turkey.
Yeah. All right, so we have one last tradition to talk about.
Okay.
And this is the North Carolina hollering contest.
I'm sorry, what?
Have you heard of hollering?
Is this the one where the women like get up on the stage and like yell at their husbands?
Not specifically their husbands. So hollering is hollering without the G. So it's hollering. And some people actually believe that hollering is the oldest human mode of communication.
Yep.
So before the invention of telecommunications, hollering was a conventional method of long distance message delivery in rural areas, most specifically in North Carolina. So many early peoples are known to have engaged in hollering or variations such as yodeling or hunting shouts. And some modern tribes continue to use this activity. In rural North Carolina, people used a vast array of hollers to communicate with each other, from simple good mornings to messages alerting neighbors of an ongoing or impending emergency.
That's really cool.
Yeah, they all had like specific meanings and they were real loud that they could be heard from very far away. Hmm. During the summer of 1952, Ray B. Brown, who was a young doctoral student from the University of California, Los Angeles, went to research folklore in rural Alabama. Brown interviewed local farmers who told him just a few decades prior, it was impossible to stand outside your barn without hearing many farmers hollering at one another over the fields. In the Journal of American Folklore, Ray described his travels and observed that the holler was expressive and practical, similar to an alpine yodel, and he called it a spontaneous overflow of the poetic urge. Okay. Folklore scholars have discovered that the practice of hollering was most common in traditionally Black communities in the U.S., especially in the Southeast. And some argue that it came from English-speaking settlers in the 1700s when men on rafts would holler at each other to avoid collisions while transporting logs down the coast. So it looks like it's just a mix of traditions.
It could have, you know, started both places independently. Mm-hmm.
Totally. In Sampson County, North Carolina, there were a few different types of holler. There was the distress holler, which locals say have helped locate lost children, save drowning men, and even ended house fires. There is the functional hollers, and these are the hollers used in day-to-day life on the farm or in the field. Each farmer or rancher had his own distinctive hollers to bring in his hogs, cattle, sheep, or dogs, and this was particularly useful when farmers' animals grazed common land, so a farmer could round up his animals with his unique holler without disturbing any of his neighbor's animals.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that so cool?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Learn just to come to the specific sound.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then there is the communicative holler, which are essentially just greetings or, you know, just affirmations of like, I'm in my field. If there's anybody out there, hello. Like. And then lastly, there is the expressive hollers, which serve no purpose and are just for fun.
Yes.
So these are usually versions of like popular songs in holler version. But in the early 20th century, of course, hollering was on the decline because the telephone and other conveniences. And also, according to Ray Brown, the stigma associated with rural poverty.
Sure.
In 1969, during a radio broadcast, Erman H. Godwin and John Thomas jokingly discussed the idea of reviving the lost art of hollering by holding a contest. But the joke turned into a real idea, and they hosted the first ever National Hollering Contest in Spivey Corner, North Carolina, with all proceeds benefiting the local fire department. In 1969, Spivey Corner had a population 48.
Oh my God.
And the contest brought crowds of people and participants and observers, including the mainstream press. The day's events featured not only the promised hollering contest, but other contests like pageants and games, as well as things like the biggest bell pepper contest or a watermelon roll and square dancing jamborees. Since the first contest in 1969, the event has drawn anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 people tiny town and has grown into a full day of family-oriented events, including a 10K hollering run, a craft show, music, and dancing. The contests are often judged by invited guests who have included a North Carolina Agriculture Commissioner, a North Carolina Secretary of State, and a U.S. Congressman. The contest and its winners have been featured on television shows such as The Tonight Show and Late Night with David Letterman. They've been shown in magazines with worldwide circulations such as Stars and Stripes and Sports Illustrated, and have even been the subject of documentary films. They've been featured on The Voice of America and mentioned in television sports commentaries. So it like got real big. But sadly, as of 2016, the contest is no longer held.
No.
Yeah, they don't do it anymore. But you can look up clips from the contest if you would like to hear what hollering sounds like.
Absolutely. I'm doing that. Yes. My gosh. One time when I was younger, we went on a family vacation to North Carolina. Because we would meet my grandparents from Florida there because it was halfway.
Yeah.
So we did that a lot of summers. And we rented this cabin, you know, up on a mountain, as you do. And we got there and my dad hopped on his bike and took off for a bike ride without like looking at a map.
Oh, no.
Or, you know, and there was no cell phones. There was nothing.
Sure.
And we're all kind of like, it's been a while. okay. Mm-hmm. But like, we didn't know where he was going or what his plan was.
Right.
And then it was like, okay, starting to get worried. And we're all sitting out on the porch of this cabin. And we hear from down the mountain, my dad yelling my mom's name.
Oh my gosh.
As loud as he could. And my mom and my grandpa got in the car and like followed his yell.
Hey.
And found him. And when they found him, he was in the process of throwing his bike into a dumpster because he was so.
No.
Yeah.
But it worked. It worked.
It worked. They found him and he got home.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I know about Punxsutawney Phil and the other strange American traditions.
That was absolutely unhinged and I loved it.
Yes. I'm so glad that's how it's described. Unhinged. Fantastic. That's how I feel.
Oh my God. No, I can't believe the shit that we do in this country.
I know. There is another one that I was going to do, but I didn't. It's ostrich races.
What?
Yeah.
We do that here?
Yep. If I said that somewhere in America there's ostrich races, what state would you guess?
Texas.
No. It is. I forgot. It's where is it? I thought it was Arizona, but I might be wrong now. Nevada. It's Nevada.
Of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
Of course okay. It is.
And then how are you picturing this happening?
I'm picturing someone riding an ostrich.
Okay, you're correct.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So when I first heard it, I was like, it's like a groundhog. Or not a groundhog. It's a greyhound race. You know what I mean? Like greyhound dogs, like, you know, on a track and they're
just
running. That
would make more sense. Yes.
That's what I thought. No, people are riding the ostriches.
Of course they are. It's America. Yeah.
So apparently it's a huge thing now. There's like a whole 3-day fair around ostrich racing. So.
Wow.
I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I have some recommendations if you want some other weird stuff.
Absolutely.
It was kind of, I mean, there's not, it's a weird topic. So I only have one nonfiction book, and that is just Weird U.S., Your Travel Guide to America's Local Legends and Best Kept Secrets by Mark Moran and Mark Schuerman. And the description is, what's weird around here? That's a question Mark Moran and Mark Schuerman have enjoyed asking for years. And their offbeat sense of curiosity led them to create the best-selling phenomenon, Weird New Jersey. But why should they stop at New Jersey when there's so much that's strange, odd, and utterly nutty all across the U.S.? So they've expanded their universe, taking their act on the road and found stories of weirdness in every state in the nation. The result is a travel guide of sorts, but to the kind of places voyagers will never find on their everyday maps. Instead, it's chock full of the local legends, crazy characters, cursed roads, abandoned sites, and bizarre roadside attractions. So come along and visit such unique spots as Midgetville, which, yep, explore long, empty, insane asylums, and go through forgotten tunnels. But keep in mind that the maniac bunny man just might be hiding out in one of them. Yeah. So that's fun.
Yes, I do love like weird offbeat stories and traditions and festivals and stuff.
Yes, yes, yes.
Our town does outhouse races.
Oh my God. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's every year Dave and I are like this could be so much bigger if they just got the right like PR person on this,
right? Is there also like cherry pit spitting?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
In yeah. Traverse City they do.
Okay.
A bunch of they have a cherry festival.
Got it. Okay.
And I believe that's part of that festivities.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of real weird stuff when I was looking up stuff.
I'm sure.
Crazy. Okay, so for fiction, it's like, what the hell am I going to do for this? So what I did was I went with a kind of Groundhog Day trope of being like stuck in the same day. There's actually a lot of books.
Yeah. Wow.
That have
You're
that trope.
So brilliant.
I don't know about that.
Man, librarians, man. You can come to them with any topic and they're like, I can make this work.
I will find a way. Oh my God. Voice just stay for just a few minutes. Okay. Opposite of Always by Justin A. Reynolds is the first one. It's a YA contemporary. It looks really sweet. The synopsis is, when Jack and Kate meet at a party, bonding until sunrise over their mutual love of Fruit Loops and their favorite flicks, Jack knows he's falling hard. Soon, she's meeting his best friends, Jillian and Franny, and Kate wins them over as easily as she did Jack. But then Kate dies, and their story should end there. Yet Kate's death sends Jack back to the beginning, the moment they first met, and Kate's there again, healthy, happy, and charming as ever. Jack isn't sure if he's losing his mind. Still, if he has a chance to prevent Kate's death, he'll take it, even if that means believing in time travel. However, Jack will learn that his actions are not without consequences, and when one choice turns deadly for someone else close to him, he has to figure out what he's willing to do to save the people he loves.
Ooh.
The next is The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton. And this synopsis is, Aiden Bishop knows the rules. Evelyn Hardcastle will die every day until he can identify her killer and break the cycle. But every time the day begins again, Aiden wakes up in the body of a different guest at Blackheath Manor, and some of his hosts are more helpful than others. With a lockroom mystery that Agatha Christie would envy, Stuart Turton unfurls a breakneck novel of intrigue and suspense. That one got a lot of buzz recently, I think. A little while ago.
Yeah, I have definitely seen that everywhere. Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is actually one that I forgot about, but I read like 10 years ago. Oh my God, it can't have been 10 years ago. A while ago. And I really liked it. It's called Never World Wake by Marisha Pessel. And the synopsis is, it's been 1 year since graduation and Beatrice Hartley has mixed feelings about joining her friend's weekend reunion. She's right to be worried. After a night out, they narrowly avoid a collision with a car on a deserted road, or so they believe. Back at the mansion where they are staying, a mysterious man knocks on the door during a raging storm. He tells them that they must make a choice. One of them will live and the rest will die. And the decision must be unanimous. Soon, time backbends. Beatrice and her friends are forced to repeat that dreadful day so many times they lose count. With each replay, events twist and fears come alive in horrifying ways. To escape, they have to vote. But how do you choose who to kill? And then how do you live with yourself? This nightmare, this nothingness, this is never world wake.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I never read anything like that, so.
I'm intrigued.
I liked that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I've got.
Yeah. That was great. Yeah. That was so fun. I know so much about groundhogs now.
I know.
I mean,
yeah.
I know so much about the way that men interact with groundhogs, not the groundhogs themselves.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wait.
Yeah.
Do you have a funny review for us?
I do. I had a book review picked out, but then after looking at Gobbler's Knob merch,
yeah,
I then wound up on the Gobbler's Knob TripAdvisor page.
I did the same thing for mine.
Did you really?
Yeah. No,
for
that's my funny. That's
for Gobbler's
funny
Knob?
Uh-huh.
Oh, shit. Okay.
No. Well, maybe we picked different ones.
Mine, okay, so mine says in part, well, the title of review is awesome, awful, not awesome.
I didn't write the title, so I'm not positive.
Okay, and really the highlight of it is where it says, the fact is, saying you've been to Gobbler's Knob is much better than the actual experience.
It's not the one I chose, yeah.
Oh my God, we have two Gobbler's Knob reviews.
This is funny.
Oh my God, I love this.
This one is also Gobbler's Knob TripAdvisor. Being that I have always wanted to go to Gobbler's Knob, I celebrate Groundhog Day every year. This was not at all what I expected. When I arrived, we went to a local diner to have lunch. It was the most uncomfortable meal I have ever had. Everyone in the diner were locals. They not only stared at us the entire meal, they spoke negative about the tourists, stating that they hated them. The locals considered Groundhog Day stupid. The entire celebration was a joke. The locals even made comments that we must have been from NYC because of the way we were dressed.
Oh my God.
Everywhere you turn, there are no parking or you will go to jail signs in town.
Straight to jail. You park in a no parking, straight to jail. Believe it or not, straight to jail.
It's a shame this area could make a lot more money off this one time of year if they had someone in charge who had vision. I would never go back. I'm glad I can say I saw it, but the way I celebrate G-Day, I like a lot more.
My God, what does this person do for Groundhog's Day?
I don't know. I need to know.
Oh my God, I know. I'm dying to know. And also, I don't know if they feel that strongly about it. Maybe they should apply for the job.
Right?
Bring their vision to this event.
It seems like they have a lot of groundhog knowledge. So I think...
It does. I celebrate Groundhog Day every year. Gosh. My God.
Yeah, so there's some nonsense.
Yay, I loved it.
All right.
Well, I hope you feel better.
Thank you. I hope people can understand me. I don't know.
You can totally understand you.
Okay, good.
For sure. Yes, you just sound much throatier than normal.
I'm going to go sleep now.
Okay. All right.
Well, yeah. Thank you for listening.
Bye. Thank you for listening to The Reference Desk.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/thereferencedesk.
And if you're interested in purchasing any of the books we discussed today, visit our bookshop storefront at bookshop.org/thereferencedeskpod.
You can find us on Instagram at @thereferencedeskpod, visit our website at thereferencedeskpod.com, or drop us an email at referencedeskpod@gmail.com.
This episode was written and produced by us.
Our music is C'est Salavie by Eric Harper, and our cover art for the show is by Maria Amaya.
Until next week, we'll see you in the stacks.